Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, September 15th, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show, friends. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Are we trapped in a cycle of political violence? And is there any real way out? These are just some of the questions we've been hearing over and over and over again following the recent killing of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk. Many Americans are grieving, others are furious, and still others are afraid. And we are seeing leaders call for calm while others speak in language of payback, saying we are at war. And so today we have two guests, and we'll explore the times in American history where we have seen bursts of political violence. We'll look at what fueled it and what led to calm and see if any of what we've learned from the past applies to today. And we would love to hear from you, our listeners, on the road, at home, and elsewhere. Our questions of the day are this: how are you processing the killing of Charlie Kirk? How can we stop cycles of political violence? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube and Facebook, please share this video, but also leave your comments in the chat.
And I'll repeat the number, 888-477-9499. The email studio2@whyy.org, asking you, how are you processing the killing of Charlie Kirk? And how can we stop cycles of political violence? Trio of local news stories, Cherry, to start us off. And first, we wanted to check in on the New Jersey governor's race between Democrat Mikey Sherrill and Republican Jack Cittarelli. It's after Labor Day. Things tend to ratchet up in intensity after Labor Day. There's lots of attack ads flying this way and that way on television and radio. Polls consistently show the Democrat Sherrill with a lead, but a lead that I would describe as surmountable.
Yeah.
Or not insurmountable. Mm-hmm. A late August poll from Rutgers gave Sherrill a 9-point edge, 44 to 35. But I'll point you to that number, 44. It's not 50. So there's lots of votes still up for grabs. And, you know, if Cittarelli can grab a lot of those undecided voters, he can still get to the upper 40s or that 50% margin. Things are also getting very tense on the trail. There's a disagreement right now about an attack ad that Sherrill is running on Cittarelli that mentions these comments Cittarelli made about increasing the sales tax. He wasn't specifically saying, by the way, that New Jersey should increase its sales tax. He is pointing to other states who had eliminated income tax and replaced it with an increased sales tax. And he actually asked for this ad that Sherrill was running to be taken down with a cease and desist letter. But no one is ceasing and no one is desisting because it is September and this is politics.
Yeah, I saw those ads everywhere on TV and on YouTube this weekend. And it's no surprise because, you know, they're going to be attack ads going back and forth. But I wanted to mention that money is being pumped into this, especially on the Republican side. Politico is reporting that the Republican governor's super PAC ponied up about $1 million to boost Cittarelli over the next week. And it's a pretty big deal because the national PACs on the GOP side didn't have much presence in the New Jersey governor's race back in 2021. And
when Cittarelli ran
and he came, and when he ran against Murphy and came within striking distance, just, you know, 3 points. They only spent $3 million at the time. And National Democrats spent about $8 million on Murphy. So just think, if they had made a bigger investment, what would have happened or what could have happened. And so now I think they're rethinking that and they may be stepping up. So we could be seeing Many more ads.
Love attack ads in the middle of my football and baseball games.
And they get you anywhere. They get you on YouTube. Nowhere, no matter where you go,
nowhere
on Facebook, nowhere to run. They will find you.
Well, look, maybe after all those attack ads, you might want to take a break.
Yes.
See some art, visit a garden. Story number two.
Yeah, Calder Gardens is the newest arrival to Ben Franklin Parkway, and it brings a modern uniqueness to the city's Museum Row. And it sits right across from the Rodin Museum, if you haven't seen it. And what may be surprising is most of Calder Gardens is not visible from the street. All you really see is greenery, like a garden area Why? Because the main galleries are actually underground. Once you pass through a modest wood and iron gable, you go about 20 feet below ground, where you get to see rotating exhibitions of works by Alexander Calder. He is a Philadelphia-born artist who grew to become one of the most influential sculptors of the 20th century. He's known for his large metal sculptures, mobiles, and three-dimensional figures, but he also has paintings, jewelry, grounded works. And Calder Gardens, according to reporters, is designed to make you feel like you're in nature. There's natural light. There's also concrete and metal, sculptures and everything. And it feels very modern. I have not been yet, but
it's not
reading
open
about
yet.
It. I know it opens on the 21st of September, but hearing the previews and reading the previews and seeing all the photos makes you want to take a stroll down there.
It sounds very inviting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just saying that, just to get through this segment. Like, honestly, like, as
you
as
look our, like you mean it, though. Your face looks very relaxed.
Yeah, I do
relaxed.
Mean it.
Like
I do mean
inviting.
It. Inviting. Just as museums go, it feels very unstuffy.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's not a lot of descriptions or maybe no descriptions on the artwork.
It's very intentional, yes.
You and the art, and you interpret it however you want. It feels very kid-friendly. And I'm very excited about this project. And it's been a while since we added a new museum on Museum Row. Some listeners will know this already, but from your vantage point outside the museum, you mm-hmm. can look down the parkway and see Logan Circle.
Yeah.
And the main fountain there was built by and designed by his father.
Yeah. And the history there. Yeah.
And then you go even further down, you get to City Hall, you look up at the William Penn statue. That was designed by his grandfather. And so I just love that conversation between the generations all along that one axis in the city. And also the different types of art that they did. And you can see how,
so different,
how
yeah.
the forum evolved over time from, the big statue in the sky to these very playful mobiles that the youngest Calder did. So I just think it's fascinating. And I hope it really seems like it's going to be a great addition to the city. And it's getting a ton of buzz.
It is. And they raised about $90 million to create this space. It's about
cool
2 acres. Yeah, it's about 2 acres on the parkway. And that's prime real estate, down the parkway.
It feels like we're doing an ad read for it. And I'm really honestly not. Like
It's been written about so many places.
It just
Everybody's
feels
talking about
like
it.
A very interesting project. And who knows if it'll succeed or not.
We
shall see. Story number three. Maybe you leave work early. To go to one of those fabulous museums.
Just a few minutes.
More and more people, it seems, are leaving work earlier. New data from the real estate firm JLL shows Philadelphia workers are leaving the office earlier than they did pre-pandemic, about 12 minutes earlier on average, according to a write-up in the Inquirer. The data is based on workers at 5 buildings in Center City, but it lines up with trends that JLL has tracked all over the country.
Yeah.
People are leaving work a little bit earlier than they did 5 years ago. Instead of leaving at 5:15, maybe 5 o'clock. Maybe that doesn't seem like a lot to you, Cherry, but for me, it was an interesting little signal that tells us how the nature of work is changing. I'm curious what you made of it.
No, I feel like people are reclaiming their time, Avi. I really do.
See, I actually disagree with that, but go ahead.
I think they're reclaiming their time. I mean, I don't think they want to physically be in the office as long as they have been in the past. And, so as soon as 5 o'clock hits, they're ready to go, right? But, people are leaving anywhere from 13 to a full 26 minutes earlier, depending on where they are. But I also think, if you think about it, we're still working though, because we're so connected. So you can still do
That's
emails
what I was
and stuff.
Say.
Yeah. So it's like,
I don't
they
think people
physically,
are reclaiming their time at all.
But people don't physically want to be at the office. They want to leave. But I think the ripple effect is interesting because it does affect the commute time, because if everybody
transit
leaves a little bit earlier,
for sure.
Transit schedules, rush hour times, there used to be this window. You have to rethink that.
Yeah.
And so I do also wonder if people going in a little bit later, like the other end of the work schedule. So you think they're still connected. They're still working.
Well, I think that's why people feel empowered. People feel empowered to leave the office earlier because they know they've got everything they need at home to finish up the day. And
yeah.
So if there's like an errand they need to run, they feel like, hey, I can jet out earlier and then I'll finish up my last half hour of work at 7 o'clock at night, because a lot of people worked from home during the pandemic. They know they've got the tools they need
true.
To finish their work at home. And it's just one of these subtle shifts. And it reminds me like when the first work shift happened early pandemic, there was this binary conversation about, will we ever go back to the office? And that missed, I think, what ended up happening, which is not did you go back or did you not go back? It's when you went back, how do you behave differently? Because you have now this expectation that work can happen at home seamlessly.
And you just leave a little bit earlier.
And you, if you need to. In fact, I think I'm going to do that today.
Yeah.
And I'm going to then do some work at night. That's the perspective I come at it.
Yeah, and you're right. Working at home is a lot easier thanks to the pandemic.
We all got our little setup now.
I know. And
So we're going to shift now.
Serious conversation coming up.
To the conversation for the rest of the hour. We're talking about the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk and what it says about our culture and our society. Stay tuned. You're listening to Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. After a gunman killed right-wing activist Charlie Kirk last week, social media platforms exploded with a predictable intensity. Partisans looked feverishly for clues about the alleged killer, and they quickly assigned blame. In this reaction, you could almost feel the rift between left and right widening.
Are we caught in a cycle of political violence? Has America been in a place like this before? And how can we get out? Many of us have been asking ourselves those questions over the past few days. And so now let us ask the experts. Kevin Kruse is a professor of history at Princeton University and co-editor of Myth America. Historians take on the biggest legends and lies about our past. Kevin, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Ruth Braunstein, associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Angora Institute. Ruth, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And for our listeners at home, we're asking you a pair of questions this hour. How are you processing the killing of Charlie Kirk? And how can we stop cycles of political violence? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org if you're on YouTube or Facebook. Hello, drop a comment right there in the chat.
And so it's been less than a week, Kevin and Ruth, since Charlie Kirk was gunned down on a college campus in Utah. You've had time to process what happened and the response. And so I want you to each give your reaction to what has happened in the aftermath of Kirk's murder. Is this part of an ongoing cycle of violence? What's your take? Ruth, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I think that we've seen over the past decade or so an escalation of our political temperature. We went from a time where people were saying that the rhetoric is getting more heated to a time where we are increasingly seeing these acts of violence, as well as more widespread threats and harassment against elected officials and political leaders across the political spectrum.
Yeah. And Kevin, do you feel like this is part of that ongoing cycle and just your reaction to the aftermath of the Kirk killing?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We are kind of deep into a cycle here. It's been ongoing for quite some time. I think we saw I'd go as far back as 2010, the kind of extremist language that was used in the Tea Party revolts, which is a wave that Trump harnessed and amplified. Certainly no one, I think, since George Wallace ran for president has injected so much violent language, threats for violence, even excuses for violence into the political sphere as much as Donald Trump has. And that's certainly created imitators on his side of the aisle and across it as well. And I think it's a really dangerous moment we're in. The reaction to Kirk's assassination surprised me in some ways. I knew he would, he was deeply in some ways adored by many on the right. I was struck by how seriously they took this, that this was something that, you know, they're talking about having him lay in state at the Capitol or putting up statues of him or likening him to Martin Luther King Jr. I think that's probably an overreading over how widely well-known he was in the general public, but it shows how deeply committed they were to this. The most striking and troubling part, I think, was the immediate rush to judgment on the part of those on the right. That this was before any evidence was in, before we even had the identity of the shooter known, that this was clearly attributed to, quote, the left, and the entire left was responsible for what was going on here. And that's wrong on multiple levels. We're attributing the acts of an individual to an entire side of the political spectrum. Also, we don't even know if he himself was on the left.
Yeah.
And so that was dangerous and I think deeply irresponsible. I'm an historian. I'm happy to wait to form an opinion on things. And so those snap judgments, I think, are a real problem that we have here.
Yeah.
You mentioned
yeah.
George Wallace, Kevin. Does this moment we're in right now remind you in other ways of the 1960s or 70s? Does it remind you of other periods in American history?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the 1960s were an era of political assassinations, and not just in terms of political candidates, John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. chief among them, but civil rights activists ranging from Martin Luther King Jr. And Medgar Evers on down to names that a lot of people tragically don't even know. And the country was awash in guns in then. Well, the response of a nation then was to enact gun control, was to roll that back, right? And it's something that even some conservatives got on board with when the Black Panthers famously obeying the open carry laws of California went into the California legislatures with their guns drawn. Ronald Reagan was suddenly a fan of gun control. And so we were able to rein in the wave of political violence by reining in the tools that do this. Whatever, this is why the arguing over what motivated this shooter or that shooter is so frustrating. The common element they all have are the guns. And in the 60s, the recognition was political violence is sweeping across this nation. It might get Martin Luther King Jr. It might get George Wallace. It's going to get somebody. And so what we should do is rein in the guns. Well, we've got the same thing today. People are being killed on the left and the right and the center. And yet there's no interest, no energy in reining in the guns. Quite the opposite. Our gun laws are getting looser as we go. And so the violence continues.
Yeah. I wonder if there's a thread, because I also looked back in time, you know, to around the Civil War. We had a big, you know, there was a battle, a civil war. There was also political violence. We had the president of the United States murdered, you know, right after the Civil War. So I wonder if there's a thread that you can draw, Kevin, and Ruth, feel free to comment on that. Are there similarities in the way America was feeling at the time that you see that are parallel to today?
And I mean, Kevin, I'll let Ruth take the lead on this, but let me just say, since you threw it to me first, there are some echoes there, but I think we're in a remarkably different period now. And again, the big difference isn't a change in who Americans are or what they do, but rather how they can express that political violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Civil War was an era in which one politician caned another, right? And beat him up pretty badly, but with a stick. We live in an era in which the political violence comes in the forms of you know, assault rifles that are capable of firing off intense damage meant for battlefields, and yet they're everywhere in our communities. And so I think that is the real difference, the technology.
Yeah. And Ruth, you want to chime in here?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's some clear parallels between those moments and beyond the kind of supply of weapons and the technology that has changed. Certainly there were periods of intense division. And one of the things that division does is it allows people to justify violence because they think that the other side is so dangerous that anything is justifiable in order to prevent them from holding power or carrying out what, you know, the mission that they are planning to carry out. And so, you know, we end up with a problem where people resort to drastic measures because they believe that the quote unquote other side does not have the country's best interest at heart. And, you know, in the case of civil war, obviously we descended into full scale war. But, you know, right now we are experiencing a period of division where people are so locked in to these partisan, you know, almost tribal divides that it's much easier for people to imagine the other side in these dangerous terms. And that allows people to justify violence. They're also increasingly understanding the political context, the moment we are in, as one of existential danger. And so whether we believe that we are facing the existential threat of the end of democracy or of the end of the quote unquote Christian nation, or, you know, thinking about eco disaster, people are really feeling extremely precarious. And the more we sort of frame our situation in terms of catastrophe or impending disaster, again, the more willing people are to imagine that violence is justifiable in the short term and in these more limited ways that political assassinations, shootings feel like a more limited form of violence that might prevent more widespread chaos later. And so really, it's a couple different levels of our rhetoric that we see across history correlating to these moments of political violence.
Let me bring in a caller. This is Wayne from Mullica Hill on line three. Wayne, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is that I believe that the state that we now find ourselves in is attributable to virtually one person, and that is our illustrious President Donald Trump. He has made othering of people who are different. He has made discussion, which includes denigration, the rule of the day. And when we get to the point where we can't have a discussion without denigrating, it generates people who believe that it is fruitless to try to agree by words, who believe it is pointless to try to have a discussion with people who are different than you. And it justifies this kind of conduct. I'm not at all surprised by the death of Charlie, because when you create a set of circumstances where people believe that the only way that your voice can be heard is if you snuff out the voice of the other person, this is the result. This result was inevitable, it seems to me, since 2016, when Donald Trump first threw his hat into the political arena. And quite frankly, both the public, both the political system, the Congress, which has no spine and won't stand up to him, the court, which have been packed by him and now enable his conduct, are all bear responsibility for where we are right now. Nobody wants to take the responsibility, but they all bear responsibility. And guess what? Yeah. The media, which I love and which has been attacked by Donald Trump, also bears some of the responsibility because we keep normalizing the conduct of a man who is obviously outside the constraints of ordinary political conversation.
I appreciate that. And I wasn't trying to cut you off specifically on the media point because it's well taken, but we just want to get it back to our guests. So Kevin Cruz, you heard what Wayne from Mullica Hill have to say. Is this, I think the question we always circle back to, or I always do, is Trump sort of the chicken and egg? Is Trump the cause of this, or is he succeeding in an environment that incentivizes politicians to behave this way, and that ultimately it's the environment, the media, the social media environment that is more the root cause? How do you break that down, Kevin Cruz?
I'm an historian, so I don't. What I do is I say it's a little bit of all these causes, right? That's our typical cop-out.
Okay.
But it's a cop-out because it's true, right? I do think Trump wasn't the start of this. He certainly wasn't the origin of kind of the ugly political rhetoric. As I said, there are people who practiced it before him, like George Wallace. There were movements in our recent past, like the Tea Party movement, that demonized Barack Obama, showing him as a witch doctor and all kinds of racist things, and calling him a traitor for trying to provide health care, things like that. So there certainly were things that predated Trump, but I think Trump tapped into that pre-existing stream and absolutely supercharged it and did more so than anyone else to do this. The caller, Wayne, I think, Wayne was dead on that. It's not just Trump. It's also how other people have reacted to him, right? We've had demagogues before. They've been reined in by the courts. They've been reined in by a Congress that was actually willing to exercise its authorities. They've been reined in by media, unafraid to call things as they are and to not normalize and sanewash.
What are those examples, Kevin, that you feel that spring to mind? Historically,
of violence being reined in the past?
Yeah.
Yeah. Demagogues, you said, being reined in by those various institutions.
Yeah, I mean, you would get called out by if you were a politician in Congress, you would be censured. Your own party would call on you to back down. What we've seen in recent years is that if anything, getting censured by Congress becomes a badge of pride they run on. Joe Wilson shouted "You lie" at the President of the United States during a State of the Union address or a speech to the joint session of Congress, but a formal speaking event, which used to be regarded as sacred. You wouldn't even make a noise during that. Stood up, accused him of being a liar. It turned out he was wrong. Joe Wilson was wrong, that Obama had not lied and he had spoken the truth, and Wilson was reprimanded by Congress. He then fundraised on that and raised about $1 million, right? Because he was a fighter who would stand up to the president and call him a liar to his face, right? So incivility has been awarded. And we live in an era now in which all the incentives, especially on the right, but a little bit on the left, are to go to the extremes, right? If you're in a gerrymandered district, your only fear is that you're going to get a challenger from the right, so you better cover that flank. If you want to get on Fox News or whatever media, you better have a hot take to bring on the air, right? You better, and if you want to get money out of someone's hands, you better call them evil, your opponent's evil, you better call them traitors, you better do everything you can to motivate that, right? So all of that there is driving. So we've got this vague pining for a sense of civility and bipartisanship, but every single motivating factor for a member of Congress now, and increasingly Senate, governors, presidents too, is to go the other way.
Yeah, and let me read a comment. We have David on YouTube who says, political violence, regardless of ideology, must be condemned. Political leaders on both sides need to come together and broadcast a unified message to America. That's what David on YouTube has to say. By the way, our question of the day is, how are you processing the killing of Charlie Kirk? How can we stop cycles of political violence? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat. I wanted to ask you, Ruth, maybe you can comment on this. Robert Pape out of the University of Chicago recently discussed their survey for May of this year, where nearly 39% of Democrats agreed with the idea that removing Mr. Trump from office by force would be justifiable. At the same time, a quarter of Republicans said it would be justifiable for Mr. Trump to use the military to crack down on protests against his agenda. FIRE recently dropped a survey last week talking about how a third of students on campuses say that it is okay to use violence to respond to people you disagree with. I want you to sort of respond to some of these surveys where you're seeing more and more people in America sort of feel like violence is justified. How did we get to this space where you're seeing more and more people say violence is okay?
Yeah, I think we certainly are seeing an uptick in that. I think it's also the responses to that seem to be highly sensitive to the framing of the question in terms of whether it is under X, Y, or Z conditions would violence be justified. And so, you know, this is something that we absolutely need to be having a conversation about and a reiteration from the very top in terms of our political leaders that there is no justification for violence and that violence is actually one of the most dangerous things for a democracy. Right? A democracy rests on the premise that we solve our problems peacefully, that we can disagree. We can disagree, you know, forcefully with one another, but that we ultimately have institutions and processes in place that allow us to work through those disagreements in ways that we view as legitimate so that, you know, the answer that comes out the other end of that process, we accept, even if we might continue disagreeing with one another forever. And so violence short circuits the very basic premises of a democratic system. And I think that needs to be kind of a clear message from the top. But as Kevin said, all of the incentives for our political leaders are to essentially sell conflict, right? To be divisive, right? That's how you get more followers on social media. That's how you get more, you know, invitations to be on TV. And that's how you're feared by your political opponents. And so, you know, I really do worry that the things that we need in this moment that we know historically have been important for shoring up our democracy are not the things that that the incentives are going to be promoting our leaders to be doing right now. I will say, though, quickly that, you know, national leaders are one thing. I have seen at sort of local and grassroots levels that, you know, student Democrats and Republicans, for example, have come together to issue joint statements on a couple of college campuses. Yeah. And there are, you know, I do think that there is a new generation that maybe has only seen this kind of division in their lives and can imagine another possible future, and we might want to be looking to them as much as we're looking to the people in charge.
I wanted to piggyback on what you said at the beginning of that answer, Ruth, about this survey data and what it actually means, because I think there is some disagreement about what's actually happening here and what the actual trend is. This is a quote from Professor Sean Westwood of Dartmouth College, writing in Politico. "To be clear, a mass movement of political violence is not happening. For the past 3 years, I have tracked public support for political violence, and the data are unequivocal. Fewer than 2% of Americans believe political murder is acceptable." And I think there's a question of whether what we're seeing is an increasing acceptance of political violence or simply a convergence of individual radicalization with access to weaponry. And that is creating the end result that we see. I'm curious what you make of that, Ruth Braunstein, whether you believe, I guess, how strongly you believe that there is truly a mass acceptance of political violence, unlike something we have seen 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly both a supply and demand question. And when we think about what political violence means, I also think it means different things to different groups. So does that mean that an individual carries out an isolated act of violence? Does that mean you participate in an organization that is promoting the kind of training with arms in order to prepare for some kind of political conflict? Or does it mean that you are open to government, right, which in sort of sociology terms, right, has a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence, that you're more comfortable with them using their enforcement power against those who step out of line. And, you know, so I think that people who are protesting publicly, right, to the extent that they see more force against them, right, we've seen this in terms of campus protests being more heavily policed, or at least that people call for more heavily policing these. We've seen this in terms of sending military, National Guard, into local spaces in order to police them. And so that also might be interpreted by people who are responding to these questions as forms of political violence that are justified in these instances of quote unquote emergency. And so I think we just need to be specific about what that means to people.
Yeah, and I want to bring in a couple callers before we go to the break. Maybe we can get a couple folks back to back. We have Kevin from Royersford on the line. Kevin, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So I have a couple questions. One is why do the liberal left not accept any responsibility for any of their actions that they've had over the past couple of years while they've been in power? So that's one. Then the next thing is why is it that gun control is so important when I grew up in a house where at any given time you could put together 40 different weapons and no one ever got killed? No one ever got shot. No one ever even got a finger pinched putting one together. I don't understand the mentality of banning cars for drunk drivers or banning guns for illegal weapons.
Thank you.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. So, wait, can I just ask you real quick, Kevin, on your first question, you were saying that the left doesn't take responsibility. Just like, I want you to sharpen that question a little bit. In what way do you not see the left taking responsibility?
Okay, so then let's look at the border crisis that never happened, that everybody says never happened, that did happen. So the whole time Kamala was in power, was charged with being the border czar, which I know you're going to probably deny that because that's what you guys do. But I'm just saying the border was left wide open.
So you're just talking general. That's what I meant. So you're not talking
responsibility
about
for
violence.
Policies.
You're talking about policy. I understand now.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm talking about the whole thing in one kit and caboodle, because absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
They accept responsibility for nothing. Not one little iota of it.
Thank
not
you.
Even when Lord Arthur
and Kevin, we have to go to a break. But that's Kevin from Royersford. We'll pick up on the other side of this and give you an opportunity, both Ruth Braunstein and Kevin Cruz, to respond to Kevin's comments. And we also want to hear from you, our listeners. How are you processing the killing of Charlie Kirk? And how can we stop cycles of political violence? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We've been talking about the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, how people are responding, and what it tells us about our politics, our culture, our democracy. Our questions to you are this. How are you processing the killing of Charlie Kirk, and how can we stop cycles of political violence? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And let me reintroduce our guests. We have Ruth Braunstein, a an associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Angora Institute. We also have Kevin Cruz, a professor of history at Princeton University and co-editor of Myth America, Historians Take on the Biggest Legends and Lies About Our Past.
I'm curious what your response to that call before the break was, Kevin. So this is someone calling us clearly from a right of center point of view,
Yeah. And
just feeling like we're not us, apparently, not acknowledging his reality. What he sees is his reality. And I mean, whether you want to address the individual points he made or just, I guess, the larger gulf that seems to bring up in this whole conversation.
Yeah. First of all, Kevin threw out that Kamala Harris was the border czar and said we would deny that. I will deny that because she was not the border czar. That was a term Republicans applied to her. She was set up to be in charge of stemming the flow of migration from other countries, going to the root there, not guarding the border. Republicans claim she was the border czar. Kevin, if you're mad at that, you should talk to the people who've lied to you. That's what I'd say there. As for gun control, I grew up in the South. My dad wasn't a hunter, but all my neighbors had rifles and guns and even some handguns on the walls in their living room, right? Locked up in a case. And yeah, there weren't this many shootings back then because we're talking about like bolt action rifles and hunting gear. We're not talking about, AR-15s. We're talking about, you know, guns that were meant to shoot deer, not guns that were meant to mow down an entire battalion in an armed conflict, right? That's the difference here. So if you want to know what's changed from that childhood, and I remember that childhood well too, my fellow Kevin, it's just not there anymore.
So how could the two Kevins have a conversation about this that leads anywhere other than, because I feel like I'm guessing, just wild guess, that the media that you two Kevins consume is wildly different. If you're on an algorithmically driven social media platform, you're seeing very different things.
And echo chambers.
I just don't even know. We started this conversation talking about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and we've gone all the way over here so quickly. It feels very illustrative to me of how these conversations tend to go. So I don't know if you could start, Kevin, and then you could finish, Ruth, about like how we even have this conversation about your disagreements in a way that moves anything forward.
Well, I mean, and I try to, I probably read more left of center stuff than right of center stuff, but I study conservatism and I find myself reading National Review and things like that. And I try to read widely and get a variety of perspectives because I find some of my ideas are best challenged from people who don't agree with my priors. And I think that's important. But again, I think the starting point here has to be facts. Again, to go back to the borders are thing, it's a minor one, but one that's stuck. A lot of people who are in these siloed media environments really believe the lies that they're being told, really believe the myths that they're being spun. And I found that when you point it out to them, that they've been lied to, they don't get mad at the people who've lied to them. They get mad at you for pointing out that they've been lied. And there's a tendency to double down on that and just say, well, I'm just going to go back to my news source that already agrees with me. To heck with you.
Yeah. And Ruth, did you want to weigh in there?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really instructive also that the specific case that he talked about was immigration and the sort of perception that, to Kevin's point, has been promoted really consistently by more conservative leaning news sites that the Democrats did nothing about immigration, do not care about immigration, had no interest in solving any of the problems related to immigration. And I think that, you know, when we actually go look at the facts, there was a bipartisan effort to create a bill that would solve a huge, not the entire problem, but a number of the issues that, you know, lots of different people across the political spectrum could agree might have been related to this issue. And the reason that didn't pass, right, is complicated, but largely was because leaders in the Republican Party wanted to be able to continue promoting this narrative that Democrats weren't doing anything to solve this problem. And regardless, you know, the point is not to say it's your fault versus your fault versus your fault, but one of the big things that I think is worth stepping back and seeing is that Americans increasingly are seeing really clearly with their own eyes that the institutions that we have, like Congress, that are designed to help us solve problems are not solving those problems. Yeah. That even when there are solutions on the table, that we are not able to actually enact those because the political sportsmanship ends up kind of superseding the desire to solve the problems. And I do think that the loss of faith in those institutions, regardless of the issue, is part of what, you know, allows Americans to start imagining, well, if we can't rely on these institutions, what are we going to rely on? And we see a breakdown in our ability to do that.
And I want to jump in here and bring in a caller who kind of, I think, amplifies what you just said, Ruth. We have Ronnie from East Falls on the line. Ronnie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I really do agree with that last point. I think that the violence is just a symptom of the larger problem that we have in this country, that people are upset, people are confused, people don't feel like their leaders are supporting them or taking care of them. And I don't think it's any surprise that they, you know, take matters into their own hands and turn to violence sometimes. I think they feel like there's violence being done to our environment. There's the violence of literally sending weapons abroad to fuel wars. There's violence of deportations and ICE arrests. I think the violence is everywhere, and people don't know how to stop it. And sometimes they react irrationally. So I think it's a symptom of just the larger moment that we're in.
Yeah, thanks, Ronnie. Ronnie from East Falls. And so that tees up my next sort of big question here is, you know, Kevin, when you think about how this cycle was sort of quelled, if you think about if we're in this place where the cycle is kind of, you know, hasn't necessarily reached a crescendo, but it's definitely rising. How do we get to a place where people don't feel like what we just heard that caller feel? So helpless, like they have no place to turn, like what Ruth was talking about, like the systems are not working. And so they have no choice but to act out. When you look back in history, when did we see the calm come?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking about this quote from Martin Luther King Jr. Violence is the language of the unheard. Right. And I think we've been dancing around this is that as the political process gets closed off. And I talked about gerrymandering, all the incentives to have politicians move to the fringes, right? Well, when they do that, people in their district either feel like they're getting an extreme version of what they want, or they're completely shut out, right? And you have no voice. With Congress abdicating its role, it seems like the people's house has no role to play here. And that's really, I think, frustrating for a lot of people. The courts, often seen as a refuge for people who have a claim on their rights, are finding they're not answering those claims anymore, right? And so as people are continually shut out of this process, well, what do they feel they've got left? If they aren't being heard, if they aren't being represented, if they aren't being listened to, well, they'll turn to violence, right? And that's traditionally been a dangerous thing. And we've seen this across the political spectrum, right? We've seen this from Robert Deere shooting up a Planned Parenthood, saying he's got to save the babies. The guy who shot up a Comic Ping Pong because he thought there was a sex trafficking ring inside, right? There are people who, A, are being told lies through the media or through their politicians, and then believe they don't have any way to act on those lies or to solve those problems short of violence. And so it's a 1-2 punch. They're being lied to and they're acting on those lies. And so I think the way to get out of this is A, to clean up our information environment. And that may be impossible with the cat out of the bag with the internet and social media, but some sort of effort to rein in violent speech online across the political spectrum would be good. But the real thing here is we have to lean in and restore democracy, right? If people feel like they can be heard the right way, if they can get change, you know, through kind of the old Schoolhouse Rock model of I'm just a bill, and you know, we can get things done by all working together and having an honest debate and having the process worked, then they won't resort to these extreme measures because the normal measures, the usual measures will be working again, right?
Let me read this comment from Laura, who says, I believe two things would put a halt to this ridiculous us versus them mentality of Americans to their fellow Americans. One, social media tycoons could easily change their algorithms to stop rewarding strong emotion, especially hate and fear. Two, if Congress could summon the courage to pass a bill that would significantly limit money in elections, get rid of PACs, and force lobbyists to get respectable jobs, we could have a sane country again.
Interesting.
It does feel, Ruth, like we're all being fed into this big internet machine, and this machine is making us meaner, and we're unable to do anything to prevent being fed into the machine. And I don't know. That's the thing I feel most hopeless about, honestly. I don't know any way out of that. I could stop my own social media usage, but writ large, I don't know any way out of that. Am I being too pessimistic, Ruth, or is that what's going on here?
Yeah, you know, I was struck by Utah Governor Spencer Cox in the wake of this has been a pretty consistent voice promoting, you know, unity and turning down the political temperature. But he also made a statement that I think was pretty provocative. He called social media a cancer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a moment right now where there are people, and this is across the political spectrum, that are recognizing the dangers of social media, whether it's for kids, which has been a big part of the conversation in terms of the anxious generation, a book by Jonathan Haidt, or all of us, right, in terms of whether it's promoting violence and, you know, division and all of those things. And so I do wonder if that's a point that people could organize around and start thinking about. Obviously, I don't know if that means, you know, you shut down social media. There are, of course, positive dimensions of social media. But I think a real serious conversation about, you know, what this has done to our society. And then I will second the comment, you know, about money in politics. This is something that people who study our political system have spent a lot of time tracking, how the massive quantities of money in our politics distorts the effectiveness of our political institutions, and, you know, pulls it away from the sort of will of the people toward the will of people with money. And that is fundamentally, essentially giving people extra votes and is anti-democratic.
Yeah, and that's how this frustration sort of builds up. We're going to see if we can get another caller in. We have Gary from Germantown on the line. Gary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, my comment, and this will be 60 seconds or less. You can find out, by the way, lots more at our website tonight, Get Courage Now, and choosedemocracy.us. So point number one is violence isn't just morally wrong, it's strategically not nearly as effective as nonviolent resistance strategy-based struggles to overthrow fascist regimes. So this is based on the research of Erica Chenoweth and others, including Philly's own famous George Lakey and Daniel Hunter. Mm-hmm. And basically the research looks at 325 battles to overthrow fascist regimes since 1900. And the mass nonviolent resistance strategies have been twice as effective as the violent strategies, 54% versus 27%. Yeah. And the good news is that only 3% of the public actually have to be engaged in nonviolent resistance to have a 70 to 80% chance. So 97 out of your 100 friends can continue to be apathetic or just go to protest marches and do nothing else, and you can still win. The other really important point is that even when violent strategies work and get rid of a fascist regime, they quickly devolve into dictatorships. They don't last nearly as long as a nonviolent strategy. And you can see that's, for example, in Nicaragua and Cuba. The second point.
Yeah, George, we got to let you go. Thank you so much. I want to make sure we get another caller. I appreciate that comment. Lots of great research cited there. Let's go to line six, JT from King of Prussia, JT, before we end the show. Hey, JT, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hey guys, mine's more of a comment. I'm actually a black man from King of Prussia area / North Philly who, you know, made it out of that area. And I was honestly, you know, a fan of Charlie Kirk. And not only because of what he stood for, I'm a very moderate point of view. Obviously, I don't agree with everything he said. But I feel as though, you know, we talk about political views and all these, like, you know, sociologic views. But at the end of the day, it's simple. Like, violence and people are like water. It could heal you, kill you, or protect you. And when we simplify that as human beings and get to the point where we view things in that nature, everything will become better if we just sit and talk. But similar to what he did, you know, he sat and talked and he was killed for it. So the ultimate thing that I'm saying is, like, at the end of the day, regardless if you're black, white, Asian, blue, or purple, we should never inherently hurt anyone based off of, their viewpoints. Because what I may think is right may not be wrong to you. It just may be a different right. Obviously, killing someone's wrong. We all know that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I feel as though as people, if we stop looking at things as more of an X and O perspective and more of a perspective of simplification, the world will become a better place. And obviously, that's easier said than done.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, and I don't have to get off, but everything is propaganda-based. It's too many people that are diving in, like you said, to algorithms. Social media is not the problem. Before social media, there was television. And guess what? Before television, the people that, when TVs came out, people were saying the same thing they say about social media. Let's get rid of TV.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's ultimately about what we consume as people and how we inherently create our own opinion. And
thank you so much, JT.
That, things are going to be that way. So
JT from King of Prussia. Thank you so much.
We do have to wrap up the show, JT. Appreciate the comment. I'll read one more from Denise on Facebook, who says, I'm practicing aggressive indifference because I'm a functioning human being with a heart and a conscience. I feel badly for those who cared about Kirk, but mourning someone who had nothing but contempt for me and my people based on shortcomings he didn't have the strength to own up to isn't on my 2025 bingo card. So in those last two comments, you can see different very different takes.
Yeah.
So I want to thank our guests this hour for sticking with us, providing a lot of insight, listening to some interesting calls with us. Kevin Cruz is professor of history at Princeton University and co-editor of Myth America. Historians take on the biggest legends and lies about our past. Kevin, thanks for the time today on Studio 2.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Ruth Bronstein is the associate professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Angora Institute. Ruth, also appreciate your time so much on this Monday.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Susan and David, who phone calls we didn't get to this hour. And by the way, George on Facebook says, violence is not how we should resolve political disputes. It is wrong. It is also wrong to spout a bunch of rhetoric that can readily incite violence aimed at certain groups. So that comment as well. Thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Thank you to Tina Calique and Al Banks, who engineered today's show. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.